Tonight I'd like to talk about having a sense of purpose in relation to this thing that brings us all together here this evening. Whether you call it your practice or meditation or sangha or Buddhism or whatever, whatever it is to you. How does that relate to a sense of purpose? Many people think that having a goal or a purpose in doing something is tantamount to clinging and therefore not a good idea. However, it's really hard to live without goals or desires or expectations. The point is not to let it get out of hand. I've often said that expectations are frustrations in training. And they haven't gotten there yet. You know, they're working on it. But, you know, desire is natural. These animating energies that we have that send us forward in life. There are many times in the suttas where Buddha discourages people from desire, pointing out the problems with it, and rightfully so, because a lot of people like desire. It's very entertaining to want a nice car or just the right person to date or whatever. We can spend some wonderful daydream time desiring. The problem comes when our psychic investment in the desire or in the expectation or in the goal is such that we can't let go. I had a conversation with a couple who are going to be getting married in the near future. That's one of the things that I do, is preside at weddings. And I like to talk with them as early in the planning process as possible. And the bride commented that she practices Buddhism and she really sees marriage as a very important commitment, but also understood that she didn't want to cling. And I said, no, it's safe, except that whenever we make a commitment, there's always the possibility that it's going to have to be broken. And in marriage, there is this commitment, most of the time, of permanence. And we all know it can't be permanent. We're human. What is put together in marriage will be torn asunder. And the art of it is to put your heart in it wholly And when that time comes, to grieve, but to remember the possibility of equanimity. There's no way around it. If we love deeply, at some point there will be a parting and there will be grief. But that doesn't have to destroy us. And that's what the practice is talking about. It's a terrible loss, but it isn't clinging. If you can remember that all things change, and yes, you go through the grieving process, but eventually you come out of it. If you were clinging, you wouldn't come out of it. There was a time in my life when I didn't have a practice, and I was very unclear about what my goal in life was, but I gave it a great deal of thought, and at some point I decided that it was to be happy without causing harm to other beings. And then when I started practicing and really studying the Dharma, I could see that this purpose in life that I had, to be happy without harming, fit very nicely in with the Dharma, the idea of ending suffering. You know, not suffering is a lot more wonderful than it really sounds. There's kind of a negative approach that Buddha taught, because we know what suffering is, and we know how good it feels when that pain goes away. But very few of us can even imagine what it's like to have no suffering at all. I mean, a really good day is a day when something has happened that makes us so effervescently happy that the suffering is just sort of put aside for the time being. And then vacation is over, or we get used to the new toy or whatever, and the suffering comes back, and we just continue to deal with it. So when I talk about this practice in relation to being happy, I'm talking about the causes of suffering going away and staying away, being resolved in this idea of spiritual growth and enlightenment and nirvana. This is what happens. We study the suffering. We study what causes it. And I'm harking back to last week's Dana talk on trusting your higher wisdom. And we adjust our practice in a way that will address our suffering so that we can understand it more and get down to the root. What's causing this? And what can end it? What can cut out that root of suffering? Because when I say ending suffering, it's like I'm going to wave a magic wand and world hunger is going to end, or, you know, no more war or whatever, no more cruelty from one person to another or our species to all of the others. But my wife, Carla, had an epiphany this last week when she said, oh, you mean right now ending suffering so that it doesn't get any worse? And I said, yes, you know, in the moment, ending what's causing the suffering. And we do that enough, and eventually it is going to be rooted out. And I've talked to an awful lot of people who've started a meditation practice, and their goals for it vary. The most common one by far that I encounter is stress reduction. It's very popular. And understandably so, because you stop doing what you're doing in life, you sit down, you try to turn your attention away from your worries, you let it rest on something soothing like the breath, and after maybe 15 minutes, the chatter is going to start to, the volume will be turned down on that chatter, and maybe even there's a little bit of quiet and calm in the mind. So you get maybe 10 minutes of tranquility, and it's pretty wonderful. For other people, the goal is not just that stress reduction, like once a day in an otherwise chaotic life, but a goal of just living life with more ease. And this is when you've done it and you started to root out these causes of the suffering. You don't have such a long list of things that drive you crazy anymore, so you're not quite as crazy. And I don't know how many people come to meditation with the goal of becoming wise, but after a while, I think we start to see that it's happening, and we like it. When I worked with substance abuse people in the drug court rehab program, I would put it in terms of better judgment, and they really got it because they understood that they had bad judgment, and having better judgment was highly desirable. That was a good selling point. By far, the most people historically who have been Buddhists, their goal was to have a better life next time. Their next reincarnation would be better because of the spiritual growth that they did in this life, or the merit that they accumulate by supporting the Dharma, supporting the monks and the nuns who carry the Dharma through dana. Most of the people that I work with don't really have that goal so much as this idea of spiritual growth, a progressive lessening of the suffering and a heightening of the wisdom. And I would encourage people to have the goal of enlightenment and liberation. There's really no reason not to. Because as we go through life and root out the causes of suffering, it's like a garden. You do your weeding enough regularly, and there's going to come a day when there are no weeds in the garden. And that is liberation. And the next day, no more weeds come, and that's nirvana. Kind of a very simple analogy of it. But if there are no nutrients left to support the weeds, only the plants under cultivation, that's what you've got. I want to move a little from the idea of the goals for meditating and what meditation leads to as a goal, to this idea of purpose. I was talking to a friend about it, trying to get up to speed myself, and she wasn't comfortable really with that word, especially in terms of purpose in life, because it sounded sort of like something that God chooses for us. Like, you know, Moses was born to lead his people to the promised land. That, you know, that was like a divine purpose. Nowadays, there's a lot more thinking of purpose in terms of meaning that gives a cohesiveness to life. Buddhism talks a lot about this precious human life because it's the perfect environment in which to achieve enlightenment. When I was in college several lifetimes ago, I took the social psychology of social movements class, and it was in a decade called the 60s. And just to show the professor that we understood what he was talking about, we took over the class. We really did. But the gist of what I learned while he was still the professor was that you have to have just the right amount of oppression on a group for them to organize and throw off the oppression. They've got to be able to feel it, but if they're so oppressed that they're hungry every day, they're not going to have the energy to fight. And that's kind of like most sentient beings. You have to be able to feel the suffering to do something about it. So if, you know, if you're this like Dewa in a heavenly realm and or Deb on vacation, you you forget to practice. Sorry, Deb, I couldn't resist it. Thank you for being here. But, you know, we've all been there. You know, things are just going so well, why practice? But then when things are going so dreadfully, it's really hard. And in the animal life, animal lives, the animal realms, it's just not possible. So being human is the perfect time to get our act together. I personally see this as the purpose that my practice has given my life, that it is about, you know, growing and seeing how much I can do to alleviate or eliminate suffering in my life and in the lives of all of the beings that I influence. Probably one of the best ways I can do this is to be happy myself. Because if you look around, the people who make other people miserable are not happy people. When I see what causes me to suffer, and I see what can be done to end the cause of the suffering, that motivates me to practice more in my formal meditation and in my life. And when I see the effects of it in my life, it motivates me to do it even more. And it really has instilled in me this overall sense of the purpose of life is to cultivate my mind and my heart for the benefit of all beings. There are a lot of different ways to say it. I mean, that's sort of the traditional bodhisattva expression, that I really am here to eliminate suffering. I was talking with a woman in Europe doing a practice review the other day, and very poetically she was talking about the old way that she saw herself. And it was pretty much a collection of desires, you know, clinging at that level. fears and delusions, just misunderstandings about things. And she was developing a new sense of self, which was a collection of the intention that she had purposefully set in her life, the experiences that she had had mindfully, her practice, and the knowledge that she's acquired. And I said, well, it sounds like your new self is a wise self. And that's how it felt to her. And I really like that idea that as we progress along, we do kind of change ourselves and become more and more this wise and kind self to which we quite reasonably aspire. I want to end with a passage from the Dhammapada. This is the version translated by Gil Fronsdal, and it's called The Mind. The restless, agitated mind, hard to protect, hard to control. The sage makes straight, as a fletcher the shaft of an arrow. Like a fish out of water, thrown on dry ground, this mind thrashes about, trying to escape Mara's command. Isn't that a great image? Has your mind ever felt like that to you? Mara's command. Mara is delusion, and you know, the god of that creates suffering. Trying to escape Mara's command. The mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The disciplined mind brings happiness. The mind, hard to see, subtle, alighting where it wishes, the sage protects. The watched mind brings happiness. Far-ranging, solitary, incorporeal, and hidden is the mind. Far-ranging, solitary, incorporeal, and hidden. Those who restrain it will be freed from Mara's bonds. For those who are unsteady of mind, who do not know true Dharma, and whose serenity wavers, wisdom does not mature. For one who is awake, whose mind isn't overflowing, whose heart isn't afflicted, and who has abandoned both merit and demerit, fear does not exist. Knowing this body to be like a clay pot, establishing this mind like a fortress, one should battle Mara with the sword of insight, protecting what has been won, clinging to nothing. All too soon this body will lie on the ground, cast aside, deprived of consciousness, like a useless scrap of wood. Whatever an enemy may do to an enemy, or haters one to another, far worse is the harm from one's own wrongly directed mind. Neither mother nor father, nor any other relative can do one as much good as one's own well-directed mind.